ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
This week, whistleblowing legislation remains a point of contentious debate about press and individual freedom. Are we any closer to a resolution?
It's the end of upfront season. The ABC rounds out the media announcements for 2026, and its managing director Hugh Marks says he has a plan.
And it's been a tough fortnight for the staff at Nine as the media job losses season continues at pace. So, Viv, do you reckon you can summon an Australian political appointee to the US Congress?
Well, I know that I certainly can't summon an Australian political appointee to US Congress, but it never hurts to ask the question.
No, and the question is being asked of Julie Inman Grant, who is Australia's e-safety commissioner, who I suppose we've tried to invite her onto Medialand, and we haven't had the powers to compel us to join us, but perhaps Congress is more influential.
Well, it's worth noting that even though she has been asked to testify before a US congressional committee over concerns that she is harming Americans' free speech, she hasn't actually decided on whether or not to agree to the request. My understanding is that if she does agree, it'll be one of the world's most awkward Zoom calls. I don't think she's actually going to go there. But she and her office have kind of made the point that given the teen social media ban comes into effect here on the 10th of December, she likely has other priorities and indeed other Zoom calls that she needs to be on in the coming weeks.
Yes, the temperature is really sort of heating up now around Australia's kind of increasing efforts to regulate the platforms in all sorts of ways, which, as you say, now very imminently includes the age gating for 15 plus. And we've seen this week, you know, Meta begin to roll out how it's going to do this. So it started contacting people who it believes are below the age of 15 and warning them to download their data if they want to carry on accessing it.
Well, I understand that some account holders in Australia who Meta believes are younger than 16 have started to be contacted, and those who want to fight their removal will have to undergo facial scans or provide ID to prove they are old enough. And I have to say, I have not been contacted by Meta, and you probably haven't either, Tim.
I have not. Meta do not want to facially scan me, as far as I know. Often as journalists, we get told to stick to our knitting, and we do love a metaphor. But this week, there was an uncomfortable amount of discussion about squeezing lemons, Viv.
Yeah, Nine's new chief of broadcasting and streaming, Amanda Lang, has a very set view about juice, which I imagine maybe the people affected by these staff cuts don't share those juice views.
Yes. Look, to give context of why we're talking metaphors, something that happened this week was Nine began to explain to its staff, and it would be the biggest commercial media organisation in the country, why it was making the cuts and where things were going. Those cuts had been announced the previous week. And they rolled out Amanda Lang, who, as you say, chief of broadcasting and streaming, so roughly half of Nine, I suppose. And yes, the phrase she used, I think in more than one media interview, was getting more juice out of the fruit, which seems to be putting different versions of a show on free-to-air television and then maybe another version on Stan. Or that was my interpretation anyway.
Yeah, I think if you were someone who was losing your job, and about 50 jobs could be cut from Nine's broadcast and streaming division, you might take issue with, I'm not sure, other people in this situation, the fruit, are they the juice? It's always so frustrating, I think, when you lose a job and people are talking in these ridiculous ways about it as if it's not people's actual livelihood and people's financial situation. I mean, Lang on the flip side said the worst thing we can do is not set ourselves up for success. And she said it's about transformation. It's not about saying they want fewer people to do the same thing that more people did yesterday. They always say that when they make job cuts in the media, you know, this won't result in more work for the people who are left. But has that ever actually happened, Tim?
No, you're right. There are certain tropes, aren't there? There's that one. The more common one now is, no, we're not going to use AI to take people's jobs away. We're going to use it to help them be more efficient. But I think the wider sort of, I suppose, vacuum around Nine, and I think this is a sort of information vacuum for staff and potentially for viewers and audiences as well, is it's now some months since Nine sold its stake in Domain, the real estate platform. So it has something like $600 million sitting on its books with something to do. And I think people are beginning to wonder, well, does the CEO, Matt Stanton, have a plan? And if so, is it just a secret plan and he can't show his hands? Or does he not have a plan, which arguably might be worse?
And also, where's the audience in all of this? You know, we're talking about getting more juice from the fruit. We're talking about lemons. We're talking about setting Nine Entertainment up for success. But I'm not seeing that much about how cutting 50 jobs and making things quote unquote more efficient is actually going to benefit the end user who might be consuming Stan or watching a program on Channel 9.
And the metaphor also sounds like the makings of a really terrible cooking show. You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
There's been a lot of discussion this year about both the importance of whistleblowers and how tough that experience can be for the people who decide to sound the alarm.
It's also crucial that journalists understand how to protect their sources. And the landscape around this feels a lot like quicksand in the digital and AI age.
Now, a reliable guide to this is Associate Professor in Law at the University of Queensland, Dr. Rebecca Ananian-Welsh. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Let's start with the obvious thing. How would you define whistleblowing?
Oh, the obvious questions are often the hardest ones, aren't they? Like, how do you define a journalist? Look, whistleblowing...
A troublemaker.
A disruptor. Look, I guess that's what a whistleblower is too sometimes. But it's a really broad idea that anyone who is blowing the whistle is calling out corruption, misconduct, abuse of power, whether that's happening in a private sector kind of space or government.
And do you have any examples of when it's cropped up here in Australia? Is there a case that people might know but aren't aware that it started with somebody blowing the whistle?
Absolutely. So look, whistleblowing doesn't happen constantly, but sometimes when it does happen, it gets a lot of attention. So one that people might know about is the Afghan Files reporting by the ABC, by Dan Oakes here. And that all started with a man named David McBride, who was he started out as an SAS, soldier. And then he was a lawyer working in Department of Defence. And he disclosed a whole dossier of classified defence information to the ABC. And that's what led to all the allegations of war crimes in Afghanistan by Australian soldiers.
Now, we've also seen similar cases reasonably well known around whistleblowers on the ATO, the Taxation Office, around robo-debt. And I suppose what they had in common each time were people inside an organisation being concerned about something which was really in the public interest to know.
Yeah, I mean, how often do you have a government department like the Tax Office or the Department of Defence or Centrelink go, oh, you guys don't know about this, but we've really stuffed up badly. Let us tell you all about it. Usually the way that information comes out is someone on the inside decides to go public.
And are there protections for those people? If someone has a whistle to blow, how do they know that they will be defined legally as a whistleblower?
So there's a theory and the practice. In theory, they are absolutely protected. There's so much science and data around the world to back up the importance of whistleblowers. And we don't want, as I said, this could be private sector or government. We don't want corruption. We don't want misconduct. And someone having the courage to stand up and speak out is a really good thing. So there's something for public sector whistleblowers called the Public Interest Disclosure Act that, in theory, gives them a complete shield. They can't be criminally prosecuted. They can't be fired. They can't be demoted. Protects them from any negative repercussions from then calling out corruption.
We often talk about whistleblowers in the context of having blown that whistle to the press. That's not the only route that's open to them, is it, though? How should a whistleblower think about who they blow that whistle to?
So we have, you know, the theory that I just said, that they're going to be protected. But the way that the legislation works creates a really narrow path to that protection. So take your regular, or what we would kind of know as regular, the speaking out to the press. That happens in less than 1% of cases. And there's a requirement that the person go through all the internal channels first. So before you go to a journalist, you go to your manager, you go to their manager, you kind of go all the way through internal channels and give that a reasonable amount of time, whatever that is. It's not defined in the Act. And then if none of that is working, you can go to a journalist.
And for the journalist, does that create any sort of ethical obligation if someone is talking to them about potentially whistleblowing to encourage them to go to other channels first, do you think?
Absolutely. So that would be, I think one thing you could certainly do is encourage them to get legal advice because it is quite complicated and there is an allowance in the Act for them to talk to a lawyer. But regardless of all that, have you told anyone else about this? Have you raised this internally? Because there's no way that they're going to be able to talk to a journalist if they haven't done that internal process first.
So if someone follows those steps and you talked about, you know, the theory and the reality of being protected, why then do we have this case of Richard Boyle, who blew the whistle on the tax office, and that has been partially vindicated by what has since come out? And yet my understanding is that he faced prosecution.
Oh, look, the practice is a whole different story. So as a lawyer, look, you tell someone all the protections are there, but in terms of actual cases, like tried and true kind of these protections working out in practice, that's not there. What we're seeing instead is prosecutors, police going for these people. So the fact that it was 7 years ago, I think it was 2017, that Richard Boyle started looking into these heavy-handed tactics where the tax office was targeting small businesses and individuals to basically make their KPIs. 2018, he talked to Four Corners, and the way that investigators raided his house, he was looking at 66 charges that could have put him in jail for 161 years. There's no forgiveness on the side of government. And we've seen that with David McBride, who's now in jail, with Richard Boyle, with Witness K, who is an intelligence whistleblower, which is really disturbing. So although the protections are there and the right noises are made, when it comes to push comes to shove, these people are targeted.
So are there prospects of reforms to this? And if so, what would you like to see change?
There's different kinds of reforms, right? So I've written looking for kind of improvements to the Act. One of the things that caught Richard Boyle out was that his actual blowing the whistle, talking to Four Corners, may have been covered by the whistleblower protections, but the court kind of interpreted it that all the work done in preparation for that, so he was taking photos of documents, which he shouldn't have been taking photos of, that collating of information. David McBride similarly took classified things home with him, created this dossier. That wasn't protected. And so that's what they were facing prosecution for. So there's a big call now, post what's happened to Boyle over 7 years, to improve the act in that way. But also just the bad look, I think, of police targeting whistleblowers in such a heavy-handed way. You know, the ABC raids in 2019, the raids on Richard Boyle, it sends a really clear message that government doesn't actually tolerate whistleblowing, even about substantiated claims.
I guess that's a bit of a challenge though, isn't it? Because if you can't photograph documents and get everything in line, it's much more difficult to blow the whistle if you haven't had time to think and prepare and get all your ducks in a row.
Absolutely. And you don't want to go to a journalist or the AFP or anyone looking like a whinger. You want to go saying, see, I've got evidence, I've got information that shows what's going on. Of course they're collating documents to stand behind them. But the fact that that's not covered is a massive weakness.
So what's the difference then between a whinger and a whistleblower? You know, if someone has seen something at work that they find frustrating or that they think might be slightly unethical, how do they know if they cross into whistleblower versus whinger territory?
The Act has, you know, a list of things called disclosable conduct, things that you're allowed to blow the whistle on, and that's corruption, abuse of power, misuse of public money, harm to people or the environment even. So it's quite specific and a reasonably high threshold. What it doesn't cover is, I disagree with the direction that this company is going with, or I think that this is unethical, but not to the point of actual abuse of power. So they're legal tests that are going to be applied to your conduct to kind of measure what's going on.
Now, one of the things which is potentially in the frame is the proposal for a whistleblowing ombudsman who presumably can sort of decide if the right paths are being followed. What do you make of that thought?
I think that would be fantastic. And there's really great stuff also going on in the Human Rights Law Centre in providing more legal advice to whistleblowers, because what we've seen in some of these scenarios is a real lack of clarity and uncertainty about who to go to. So one great example of that is Witness K, who is an intelligence operative who blew the whistle on Australian intelligence agents bugging the East Timorese cabinet rooms in the context of a treaty negotiation. So, you know, your multi-billion dollar treaty over oil reserves, and they bugged the other side so they could get an advantage in that. But, like, against international law, everything. Witness K went to the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, so really good insider person. They told him to go to a security-cleared lawyer, but they shouldn't have. Because when he went to that security-cleared lawyer, Bernard Collaery, that wasn't covered by anything, and he was later prosecuted for revealing intelligence information, as was Bernard Collaery. So that bad advice landed Witness K in jail and subjected Bernard Collaery to years of a prosecution, which was eventually dropped by the Attorney General. So these kinds of... McBride similarly went to the AFP, didn't know how long he should wait, really, before he then went to the ABC. Having someone else to go to say, look, you're going to have to tick these boxes, or you're never going to be covered, or all right, I can help you with this process, would be so good.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National with Tim Burrows and me, Vivian Kelly. We're speaking to Associate Professor Rebecca Ananian-Welsh about whistleblowing. Rebecca, we seem to be focusing a lot on the negatives here, the prospects of being prosecuted, going to jail, not being protected. What are the benefits of whistleblowing? You know, I feel like people out there might be getting quite a bleak picture if they're sitting on something terrible that maybe coming forward isn't worth it.
And that's the big fear, that chilling effect, isn't it? But all the evidence, as I said, studies from around the world show that whistleblowers, you can imagine the kind of enhancement of democracy and accountability, having Robodebt called out and the justice that was done for those families, having the Brereton inquiry into war crimes by Australian soldiers in Afghanistan, flushing all of that out, is amazing. but also money. So when people are engaging in misconduct, abuse of power, it costs a lot of money, and calling that out can save companies millions. So whistleblowing is a really, really important part of the system. And not all whistleblowers are prosecuted, not at all. Many save lives, but they... The important thing is to have them protected.
And you're making a very good case for the value that a whistleblower can serve to the public interest, sort of rather than the whinger side of things. Within Australia's culture, you know, we often say Australians don't like dobbers. How do you think that Australians generally feel about whistleblowers?
I don't think it's a really well understood thing in Australia. I think there's that conflict between, oh, don't whinge about it and don't dob, versus we really don't want abuse of power, right? We have a bit of tall poppy syndrome. If someone's at the top and they're doing the wrong thing, we do think, fair go, they should be called out. So there's a tendency, I think, for whistleblowers to feel like they really need to justify their conduct. And a lot of them do suffer mental health issues afterwards from people going, oh, well, you shouldn't adopt. And even feeling internally like that was the reaction that they got. That's why, I mean, it is important that you're protected from legal outcomes, but also that demotion, losing your job, other kinds of reprisals are all, the whistleblower laws do provide a shield from that, or they try to.
So what could the media and individual journalists do better in terms of defending sources like this?
So one of the big things that is always important for journalists, but really comes to the fore here, is protecting source anonymity. So when a whistleblower, or any source obviously, doesn't want to be public, wants to be anonymous, it's super important that everything is done to protect that anonymity. And here you're in an environment where the government or the police may well go quite hard at trying to identify that source. So making sure that as far as possible, you're using encrypted channels of communication, that you're not just transferring documents over email, that things are being dealt with really securely, especially if there is, of course, any sensitive information being communicated.
If I were thinking of whistleblowing about something and I came to you for advice, I'm hearing an awful lot of trouble ahead by trying to serve that public interest. Is there not an argument that people are best off just not blowing the whistle?
Look, I think this is something that journalists really can understand. There's a lot of safety in silence, but there's the public interest, and the people that we see blowing the whistle and the journalists that team up with them to tell the story are driven by that public interest and the right to know and the good things that can come from this. It was a whistleblower that revealed up here in Queensland the Dr. Death kind of story. Lives can literally be saved, and these people are willing to put themselves on the line. Journalists can play an incredibly important role in protecting them all the way through, in saying, all right, what have you done so far? Who else have you told about this? Go and get yourself some legal advice. There's special whistleblower lawyers who can help you. And then if we are going to do this, we need to be aware of what could happen and really make sure it's in the public interest. There's a lot of stories that are told that are in the public interest, and the police are not going to come after you for that.
So I think the message is, please carry on thinking of whistleblowing.
Absolutely. It serves such an incredibly important role for democracy, for everyone.
Our guest was Dr. Rebecca Ananian-Walsh, Associate Professor in Law at the University of Queensland. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Well, finally, Viv, it feels like the longest ever TV upfront season, and we've just been through it, and I think we can now declare it closed, can't we?
Yeah, although I think the ABC prefers the word showcase for their announcements about what's happening next year, which they made on Thursday.
And it was a big week for the ABC with the managing director, Hugh Marks, also speaking to the National Press Club this week.
The ABC stands out as a precious national asset of a kind you won't find in many other countries. We're not beholden to political patronage or commercial investment or those lovely touchy advertisers. And we are free for everyone. We're available to anyone on all devices at any time. There are no paywalls that lock people out. We are funded by and for the public.
So, Tim, with the showcase and Hugh Marks making this speech at the press club that we just heard, is this Hugh Marks' vision for the ABC finally coming together, do you think? Or is he sort of just still ticking the boxes of things that were done before his time here, before we see what he really wants to do with the national broadcaster?
Well, I think we're beginning to see a little bit of it. So for context, Hugh Marks came across his previous role, there'd been a slight gap, but was the boss of Nine, the entertainment company. And he came on board with the ABC very much talking about himself as a content guy. And certainly what is true is I think there were more announcements of Australian content from the ABC this week than there were from 7, 9 and 10 combined this year. So definitely lots of conversation about what people will be seeing on their screens.
Yes, one of the big criticisms I think of the commercial networks this year was that so much of their showcases or upfronts were about technology or AI or offering to advertisers, which of course the ABC doesn't have to contend with. So they could focus much more on their social media output, but again, from a content perspective, and then new program commissioning, which was much stronger from the ABC rather than the commercial networks, which really stuck to their bread and butter under the argument that consistency in this economy and in this content environment is better than taking a content risk.
There are lots of examples, but a couple sort of leapt out to me that I'll be looking out for, one of which is the ABC is doing its own dramatisation around RoboDebt. We obviously previously talked about a project for SBS, and the other one is a comedy about the AFL stadium for Tasmania, which we have seen Utopia take a swing at that topic. And I was on stage moderating a panel in Hobart on Monday night talking about media and marketing locally in Tasmania. And believe me, the number one most contentious topic in Tasmania remains the question of whether it's worth spending $1 billion of public money on bringing the Devils to Tasmania.
Well, look, we know that people love to have a whinge when the government spends $1 billion on something. So that sounds like the perfect show to be on the ABC.
Remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And do you think whistleblowers who speak to media should be protected by federal law? We would love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Thank you to our producer, Rob Kelly. We will catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle pip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.